and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer, Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering Kingston City Council's decision to move forward with a controversial waterfront high-rise.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
Yet another controversial development came before council at their meeting on Tuesday night, this time a high-rise at Kingston's waterfront containing luxury apartment units. 5 Lower Union Street, currently a vacant wharf next to the Great Lakes Museum and Historic Dry Dock, is the site proposed by developer Homestead Land Holdings. The 19-story mixed-use building laid out in the proposal would provide 118 units, with 225 bedrooms total. The journey to council approval has been long for this proposal, with discussions starting in 2019. Councillor Connie Glenn started the discussion, cautioning council against moving forward with the development. Her first key concern was the community response.
It was a very contentious build, and I think that one of the fundamental issues that was brought forward is the community felt a lack of consultation. And I know that there are going to be a lot of counters to that. However, unfortunately, this development took a long time to make its way through the system. So initial consultations took place before this council even came into being. It was under the previous council, and a lot of it took place virtually. So there were a number of individuals, I think, quite caught off guard by this and wanted the opportunity to speak against it. But at the end of the day, when we're building a community, it's important that the community feels we're actually building with them. And this just didn't hit the mark in that way. They felt that it was being built despite them, despite their legitimate concerns, and despite the fact that they felt they had a different vision for our city. And ignoring the concerns and the vision of constituents who actually currently live and reside in this place, I think is fundamentally going to be problematic for us as we move forward. I know that we say we're listening, but sometimes I'm really concerned that we're not hearing them.
In addition to the consultation piece, she also expressed concern regarding what this could mean for the future of Kingston's waterfront.
I also think that we are challenged here with what we are doing along our waterfront. We're seeing multiple proposals for various things to go along the waterfront. And we've heard criticism from the community about putting more tall buildings right on the water, like other cities have done, only to regret them much later on because that space is no longer there for the community.
Glenn concluded, noting a criticism that has come up with many recent residential developments.
I asked some questions about the affordability of this, and the reality is that these are not going to be affordable units. They're going to be very expensive units on the water. So yes, we're in a housing crisis, but the housing crisis is one of affordability. So until we're building more affordable units, like the ones that we're looking at for Verona, I don't think that we're making the mark, and I don't think that this makes the mark.
However, Councillor Wendy Stephen represented a different perspective.
The property taxes that come from this new build will feed into our operating budget. And our operating budget is what we use to do things like supportive housing. And we just approved supportive housing, and we know it's going to be expensive, and we need that money over time. So I think the argument that this isn't affordable housing, I mean, yeah, it's not, that's true. But through those property taxes, that generation will allow us to create more. We also need housing of all kinds. We've been through this a million times. We are in a housing crisis. We are still short. This will help.
In addition to this point, she mentioned some of the positive features the development could bring to the waterfront.
It's not just private residential. It is that. But it's also got continuation of the waterfront trail, which wouldn't be possible unless this land was developed. And it's also adding in green space for the community at the waterfront. Like, this is a win.
Ultimately, the amendments required for the development to move forward passed with a vote of 10 to 3.
I think that once it is built, I think people are actually going to like it.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for YGK News, Owen Fullerton, about the creation of a new research network at Queen's University.
Thank you, Jesse. The Queen's University Center for International and Defense Policy announced two grants to support the launch of the Global Feminist Resilience Network last week, totaling $30,000 to help fund the network that will connect existing research programs in a data preservation effort. Dr. Stefanie von Latke, Queen's Faculty of Arts and Science researcher and co-lead of the network, says the main priority of the network is to push back against the growing backlash against equity, diversity, and inclusion efforts and expertise, especially in the United States. The network connects Queen's and other institutions in Canada and throughout the world that have launched initiatives related to women, peace, and promoting gender security. Dr. von Latke says the role of the network will be to preserve data that in recent years has found itself in danger of erasure, with some expertise and data sources disappearing already. The aim of the work done by the network, she says, is to allow policymakers and the academic community to continue to do their work through a gender lens, and for the next generation of experts to be aided in their work in what has become a more hostile research environment. It's a partial response to a growing wave of dismissiveness towards scientific evidence and pushing policy in spite of that evidence. So far, Dr. von Latke says some actions taken in the United States have been devastating in the short term, and that it's important now to try to take a long-term view of preserving evidence for a time when the political climate is more welcoming for this type of research. The network will bring together a variety of experts at universities worldwide, but Queen's will act as the de facto hub and home base of the research network. Dr. von Latke says the CIDP already has an engaged community of experts on gender and security and provides a foundation to further build upon, with different roles becoming more specified as it gains legs. While the network's genesis has largely been in response to the suppression of certain areas of scientific research in the United States, it doesn't mean that there aren't concerns and such growing trends in Canada and other democracies. Dr. von Latke says some experts fear that if the type of political rhetoric seen in the United States is able to thrive, the country's massive influence could force other countries to turn a blind eye or even turn back progress made on gender equality issues. The network's official launch, or first meeting with all partners, will take place in Brussels, Belgium, on the week of October 13th. Thank you to Owen Fullerton for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with a story from the LGAR reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about Gananoque Town Council's request for clarification on Mayor John Beddoes' budget directive.
Thank you, Dinah. Gananoque Council has unanimously backed a motion from Councillor David Osman requesting that Mayor John Beddoes provide more detail on his use of Ontario's strong mayor powers to guide the town's 2026-2027 budgets. The motion, seconded by Councillor Anne-Marie Coyner, asks Beddoes to present supplemental information on Mayoral Directive 2025-002 at the September 16th Council meeting. Council will then be able to comment on and vote individually on the 27 items in the directive. Osman noted that the strong mayor powers were still new and that Council wanted to understand how they worked. He called the budget a $25-plus million document that requires input from staff, management, and Council. Beddoes welcomed the feedback. The mayor's directive, issued under Ontario's Strong Mayors Building Homes Act, sets out priorities including parking enforcement changes, tax and fee adjustments, and potential marina expansions. In the area of parking enforcement, the mayor suggests measures such as clamping Quebec-plated vehicles to ensure compliance. Beddoes has said that the measure stems from an inequity, as Ontario drivers who do not pay parking tickets cannot renew plates or driver's licenses, whereas Quebec residents face no consequences because the province lacks a reciprocal enforcement agreement. The draft budget will undergo council review and public consultation this fall before any decisions are made.
Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the relocation of a youth hub in Greater Napanee.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. The Greater Napanee Youth Services Coalition will be moving to the Napanee train station. With another program currently in the space, moving will begin September 2nd. The coalition will then begin to use the west side of the building as a youth services hub for ages 12 to 29. The program that currently occupies the space is run by the Morningstar Mission, a full-time mission providing food, fellowship, prayer, and other essential services. Director of Parks, Recreation, and Culture with the Town of Greater Napanee, Chris Brown, spoke about the cooperation that helped plans come together.
Exciting stuff. We're happy that everyone was able to come together and make it work. And I'm thankful for everyone that assisted me with meeting me on site, going over everything, and just being very receptive to moving from the Morningstar, and also for the Youth Services Coalition. I do remember a quote that day that was, "We got to start somewhere." And I think this is going to be a really good opportunity.
Brown detailed some of the timeline for how the moves have come together.
Back in May, Council received a deputation from the Greater Napanee Youth Services Coalition seeking the town's support for a one-year pilot project to establish a youth wellness hub at 12 Market Square. At the second meeting in May, staff brought back a report just to discuss the building at 12 Market Square and look for council direction. Council was still interested in staff continuing those discussions with the Greater Napanee Youth Services, just regarding potential partnership opportunities and exploring alternative locations for the youth wellness hub. And so council directed staff to provide an update on those discussions at July 22nd meeting, which we didn't have enough time. So since then, staff have met with the Greater Napanee Youth Services Coalition at the Napanee train station, specifically on the west side of that building.
Brown spoke about the space in the west side of the train station.
The west side of the train station building is currently occupied by the Morningstar Mission's furniture program. So in order to make the youth services hub work at the train station, staff then reached out to Morningstar Mission and their volunteers to find a suitable location to move that furniture program. The furniture in there from the program currently leasing that space was a little bit in the way, but we were able to do a little bit of a tour to look at the space. They did inform us that they would be interested in going into that space if it was available.
Brown spoke about moving the Morningstar Mission to the Conservation Park Garage.
We figured that the best place to start would be the Conservation Park Garage. So we met the Morningstar Mission staff and volunteers at that site, and we toured. The garage is split into a couple different sides. One side's a little bit smaller, easier to heat, armed, locked cameras, which they were very happy to hear, a little bit closer to the mission itself. And so they said they could make it work. We will be looking to move the furniture that's in the train station west side right now down to the Conservation Park Garage on September 2nd, starting around 9 a.m. And then once that happens, we'll be giving the train station west side a deep clean and then inviting the Youth Services Coalition to come look at the space again as a vacant space and then start to move their stuff in.
Brown detailed the next steps for staff and council.
One thing that we'll want to do is we'll want to make sure that we have facility use agreements drafted and brought back to council for final approval. So the Morningstar Mission would move their furniture program to the Conservation Park Garage, and then the Youth Services Coalition will then start to move programming into the train station west side. We'll get a nice sign. East side of the train station will say via rail. The west side would have a new sign for this youth services, wellness hub, youth services coalition.
Councillor Angela Hicks thanked community partners for their cooperation.
I would like to say thank you to the community partners, the Youth Wellness Hub and Morningstar, for being flexible. And I think I can say for once, everybody's happy.
Mayor Terry Richardson showed his support for the move.
It's kind of nice when a plan comes together and we've got it, you know, we've made two groups happy. So that's good.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about a fundraising partnership between the Northumberland United Way and local auto dealerships.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. A two-month fundraiser from the United Way Northumberland will see donations made by area dealerships on the purchase of a vehicle. The Cars for Community campaign is hoping to raise funds to support housing, food access, and mental health services in Northumberland County. United Way Executive Director Alicia Van Dyne says they have an ambitious fundraising goal.
Cars for Community is a fundraiser that our car dealership started about 4 or 5 years ago, and they donate $10 from the sale of every car between September and November. And so it started out with just one dealership. We had Cobourg Honda. Nick over there was the one who came up with this idea. He had seen it in another market. And we started approaching other dealerships to join in. And, you know, I'm really proud to say we've got 5 on board this year, which is really exciting. So we've got, of course, Cobourg Honda, we've got Cobourg Mazda, we have Cobourg Kia, which is new this year, and Campbellford Chrysler is returning to this fundraiser. So also want to send our thanks out to the True North Auto Brokers, brand new last year. So it's been a growing little fundraiser for us. The community is always so generous that people that are looking for a new vehicle, often they'll make a donation and the dealership will provide that to us as well.
So then, take us back. You started out with one dealership. They approached you. How did you see this program expand into the dealerships? How did you approach the dealerships and say, this is a good initiative? And then how have you seen the amount of vehicles being sold and seeing the pot of money rise?
You know, I think all the dealerships are just looking for a way to support charity, and it just seems to make sense for them. It's almost like their workplace campaign. And so when you think of our manufacturing partners like Cameco and CPK, who do the traditional payroll deduction, this was a way for the dealerships to do a workplace campaign without having to do the payroll deduction.
So have you seen kind of like a bit of a rivalry, maybe in terms of inside the dealerships and among the dealerships themselves, to see who can raise the most amount of money?
You know, I think that just stems from the culture of car sales, because they're all a competitive environment. And for us, over these 2 months, there's a little bit of community competition too. So that's always lovely to see.
So let's talk about what the money does, this program. Where's the money going, and how do you see that benefiting the community?
And so this money directly goes into the investments that we make into the community in our 3 pillar areas: kids can be all they can be, building strong communities, and lifting people out of poverty to possibility. And so the money that we raise through Cars for Community is going to directly support those investments that we're making in the community, in our other not-for-profit partners. And so it's kind of a multiplier, if you will. People make a donation there, and we're able to suss out the best charities to select and make sure that the money is going to great causes. And this year, just a little addition for our special anniversary this year, we had some of the car part and auto sector partners want to support the dealerships in this, and so they were able to provide a donation to us. And so this year we have East End Auto Repair, we have NoCo Auto Works, and the Brighton Automotive and Industrial Supply, and of course one of the newest businesses in town, the Tinney Auto Spa. And so they've made a donation in support of Cars for Community, and it's really nice to see the car sector working together. I think in the world that we live in today, they're definitely the folks who are feeling the biggest pinch, and yet they're still community minded, and it's very inspiring.
Now, what's the fundraising goal this year?
So this year, our goal is to make $10,000. Last year, we did just over 6, I believe. So it's a little bit of an aggressive jump this year, but we're going to see what we can do.
So outside the dealerships that you're working with, what changes have you seen, or are you trying to
get you to that $10,000 mark?
So I think what you're going to see this year on our social media, we have some reels that we're going to do and interview some of the sales folks just to help encourage people to let them know. Because as you know, thanks to Small Town Radio, we're able to reach out to so many listeners, but social media is definitely something that you'll be seeing over the next couple of months on our pages. So I would encourage listeners to go and see and check out the businesses that we're featuring.
Now, if I don't purchase a new car, how do I still participate in the program?
You can actually make a donation by calling the United Way office, 905-372-6955, and just say, I'd like to make a donation in support of Cars for Community, and we'll add that to the total.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, September 11th, even warmer still, a daytime high of 23 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud. However, it is going to drop down to 8 degrees overnight, so we are starting to get those chillier fall evenings. Friday, September 12th, daytime high of 19 degrees with sunny conditions. Saturday, September 13th, daytime high of 20 with an overnight low of 13. Sunday, September 14th, 75% chance of precipitation in the area with a daytime high of 21 degrees and showers all throughout the day. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, September 15th, daytime high of 22 degrees with a 70% chance of rain in the forecast. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Let's begin with road closures. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne, closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Cranbrook Street, Lakeview to Days, closed on school days from 8:40 a.m. to 9:20 a.m. and 3:20 p.m. to 3:50 p.m. for School Street at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic School. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Innovation Drive, John Marks to Innovation South, closed September 10th at 7 a.m. to September 18th at 6 p.m. for the installation of storm and sanitary sewers. Kings Court Avenue concession to First is closed until October 10th for a gas main installation. Lincoln Drive at Bay Ridge closed until September 19th for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Montreal Street at Rideau and Railway is closed September 11th at 11 p.m. to September 12th at 6 a.m. for paving operations. Princess Street at Taylor Kidd and John Counter closed September 10th at 11 p.m. to September 11th at 6 a.m. for paving operations. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Woodburn Road, Hitchcock to Whitechurch is closed for a contractor to complete culvert relining. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Cataraqui Woods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Gardeners Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle. Expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. John Marks Avenue and Innovation Drive. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to start work on John Marks Avenue, Innovation Drive, and Discovery Avenue. Work includes curb, sidewalk, asphalt milling, and repaving. Lancaster Drive, Limestone to Jasper. Expect delays while a contractor completes construction of a new sidewalk and road improvements. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users and accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Trudell Road, development to Danbury. Expect delays while a contractor completes road and sidewalk improvements. And Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection from Seth W.J. Hunt's new album, Almost Famous, Almost 25, a collection of songs about heartbreak, anxiety, and the search for self-worth. Written in New York City and recorded in Kingston, the album tells stories of love, loss, and trying to find where you fit in. The music is honest and melodic, blending raw emotion with classic influences from The Strokes, Ryan Adams, The Cure, Oasis, and The Beatles. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Almost Famous, Almost 25 by Seth W.J. Hunt on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it now called Lose My Head with us here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
I think I like this light. I think you like it too. Sit in the park, people watching, I'll talk shit to you. Sunsets are getting lonely, sunsets are getting dull, but you're still here beside me, so I'll cherish everyone I know. Been thinking about my drinking, say I need to cool it or you're gonna lose it, and I laugh. You and I will enjoy these times. Times before I go and lose my head while the song.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Plugged in My Ears. You're here for episode 2. This is Adam from the Kingston station, CFRC 101.9, and joining us is Sam Schoenfeld from McGill University. Sam, pleasure to have you here. Are you excited for this episode?
Yeah, well, I'd like to mention, too, I used to go to Queens, so I'm not so unfamiliar with the area, but it's true, I am in Montreal. But no, I'm excited. And oddly enough, we didn't mention this in the intro, and I don't think I'd mention it otherwise, but it's just kind of cool. I'm in a cube right now in the middle of a library, and it's soundproof, but people can see inside. So in theory, I could scream, and they wouldn't hear me. Granted, I told Adam I probably wouldn't do that, and I think for the purpose of our show, I'm also not going to scream. However, it is a really unique setting. We used to record these in the station all together, and that time is now since passed. Speaking of things which have unfortunately lasted the test of time and been a great thing, they now come to an end. Specifically, Ken Dryden, unfortunately, an alumni of McGill University's Faculty of Law, to be specific, passed away. And Adam's a big Montreal Canadiens fan, but on a very fundamental level, it is sad that someone like him passed away. I don't think people really realize everything Ken Dryden accomplished in his life. Not only is playing in the National Hockey League one of the hardest things to do in the world, but he was arguably one of the best goaltenders when he played. I don't know where he fits in the question of all time, but he was good enough for people to know his name still today. Then he also became a very prominent lawyer, an advocate, and afterwards, to some degree, a politician. Mm-hmm. Definitely not a career politician, but a politician in many respects. And the one underlying feature that translated through all of his professions, I think, was likely his kindness, sympathy, and generosity. And it's not just a loss for the Montreal Canadiens or the NHL or the legal profession, but on a very profound level, it is a loss for this country. And that's sad that he's passed.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more, Sam. Yeah, definitely a major loss for the hockey community, honestly, for the Canadian community. But Ken Dryden was something else. I mean, he only had a short career. He only played about 8 seasons in the NHL, but 6 Stanley Cups and 5 Vezinas in 8 years is ridiculous. Taking time off in between that to become a lawyer, I mean, that's just unheard of these days. I mean, I don't think too many NHL players are taking on a second job, let alone a career in law. So this was a crazy loss. Rest in peace, Ken Dryden. Everything he did for the game and for his country. He's a great, great person and a great player. But moving on to some other news regarding the NHL. They just got their collective bargaining agreement for this upcoming next 2 years. And it introduced some new things. So the regular season is expanding to 84 games instead of the traditional 82. And I know, Sam, you love talking about stats and how much in milestones and how much they matter. Do you think adding the 2 extra games at all is going to inflate any of these stats or records? Like, does this give Connor McDavid or even Alex Ovechkin a chance to stretch his goal lead over Wayne Gretzky now that he's playing 84 games? Do you think that's a big deal?
I think points per game will always be the greatest teller of tales. And it probably does give them a better chance of adding more points. At this point, Ovechkin doesn't really care about his points per game, so it definitely gives him the opportunity to score more goals. At the same time, I guess it's 2 games more where he could get hurt and end his career, so you could look at it that way too, although in reality, 2 extra games is not that much. I think for the NHL, it's a great way to make more money. The players per game probably are making a bit less money than they would have made otherwise. Granted, I don't know if this is mentioned in the collective agreement, although I'm pretty sure the salary cap's actually going up quite a bit in the coming years. I think by a pretty substantial amount, actually, every year from this upcoming year onwards for the next 3 years. I think by 2028, They've agreed that the salary cap at that point will remain in place for at least a year after that, and then they might reconsider bargaining for higher salaries. Although things are looking pretty good in the NHL. Like, yeah, it helps. It helps a lot of players. Like, this is, I don't know. The more games, the better. The only fear is that with 84 games, you play more often. And it's not that big of a difference yet, so it doesn't matter. But if they take this too far, it will become a problem when players don't have enough time to properly recover and properly train. Playing a lot of games in that short period amount of time isn't super easy. And I think one of the best examples of a sport that maybe went too far is baseball. Tons of pitchers in baseball completely bash their elbows because they play too much. And the scale is a lot different. They're playing 160-plus games. I believe it's 164 games in a season. And the extra 100-ish games, extra 80 games, to, I guess, specifically in this case, takes a severe toll. So 84 probably isn't the end of it, but yeah, a few things. One, players are going to make a little bit less per game, not that they really care. It'll allow guys like Ovi the chance to score more goals, even though they no longer care for points per game. Legacy won't matter anyways, because it's always been about points per game. And yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
No, I'm on the same page as you. I do think one of the major changes of the CBA was the addition of the playoff salary cap, which has been missing for the past few years. So this kind of eliminates, I know in 2021, Nikita Kucherov was on the IR going into the playoffs, didn't count towards Tampa Bay's salary cap. So they were able to load up at the deadline and go in over the cap. And then all of a sudden Kucherov is back, right? And able to play out the playoffs without being under the salary cap. And I mean, Vegas did it with Mark Stone. It's like, this is like something that I think has been very much needed, and I'm very happy that it was implemented. The 84 games, I think, is kind of a whatever. Like, you know, it's two more games.
It's
not that significant. And I honestly think that if they do anything, they'll probably shorten the preseason a little bit, because they've shortened the preseason a ton over the past few years. I think it's now only down to like 2 or 3 weeks of preseason hockey. I mean, we almost had a month we used to back in, but they would run from like late August or September. So I think having this is like, just like cutting back on games that don't matter as much and adding maybe a few more. But yeah, no, really, really interesting stuff out of the NHL. I mean, this is not the most exciting time usually. I mean, a few teams have just released like their training camp, rookie camp rosters. I mean, there isn't really too much happening here, but it is a good time for rumors and, I mean, some offseason deals too. So last week we saw Carey Price's contract get traded to the San Jose Sharks, which is kind of expected. I think a lot of people said that by September 1st, Montreal was looking to move that contract. But
just out of curiosity, Adam, why do you think San Jose took that contract? I don't think anyone is under the impression that Carey Price expects to return. Well, why would they take that contract?
The way I look at it is that now that they were already over the salary cap, but San Jose is a team that is going to be selling at the trade deadline. So they don't want to get any penalties going under a cap. So trading off all of those UFAs is going to lower their salary cap at the trade deadline. Now having this $10 million buffer with Price's contract makes it a lot more feasible for them to be able to trade players that are on either higher deals or just trade a lot of their older UFAs that will still contribute to the salary cap, but it makes it easier for them to move them at the trade deadline, essentially. They won't incur any fines or penalties, which they may have if they didn't have that $10 million buffer. So, I mean, I'm thinking about players like Tyler Toffoli or like older players on the Sharks that may get traded at the trade deadline, depending on how they're doing. Now it's more, it's easier for the team to trade them without giving up as much. And it goes from like being a team needing to like send a draft pick with the player to now the team just trading the player. So it's kind of just a resource move, logistical. I don't think Carey Price is suiting up for the Sharks anytime soon since he's got one knee. But it was kind of heartbreaking to see Montreal trade away my childhood legend. I mean, I'd only ever watched hockey with Carey Price in the league until the last few years, and it's just crazy to imagine him on another team. Was there ever a player for you, Sam, that was like an Ottawa legend, and just seeing him on a different team or them getting traded was like, wow, am I getting old? Yeah. Or like, what's this going on?
And I still remember the day Daniel Albertson was traded or signed. He didn't trade to get traded. He signed with the Detroit Red Wings. Mm. And I think collectively every household in Ottawa lowered their Canadian standards to half-mast. That was a moment of mourning. That was really sad. But it was a nice ending because he came back. And I'm not sure people remember this, but he signed with Ottawa for 1 year after the year he spent in Detroit. And he played one game that year, only one game. Mm. It was his retirement game, and he only played the first period. And the clock stopped at 11:11 in the first period, and it was 1-1. And the entire arena chanted Alfie, Alfie, Alfie for a long time before anything resumed. And they didn't even take a commercial break. They just recorded the fans chanting Alfie. So, yeah, I get it. It's the same equivalent as that. Those were some of the most emotional times in my life as a hockey fan. But speaking of childhood heroes that I had, or people I certainly admired, Sid the Kid is looking to come back home to Canada, maybe not to Cole Harbour, but if anything, apparently the Montreal Canadiens are interested in him. And Adam, you said the quote that he said earlier, I don't want to paraphrase, but it was something along the lines that it's not a bad team to get traded to.
Yeah, no, my toes are curling just thinking about Sidney Crosby on the Montreal Canadiens. And he just was just interviewed at the Team Canada. They're still doing that training camp, I believe. I believe that's where he was at when he was interviewed. And he was asked, how does it feel like to be... What do you think of all these rumors going around? And he alluded to the fact that it's not a bad team to have interested in you. And he said that it happens when you're on a losing team. That, I mean, Pittsburgh hasn't made the playoffs in 3 years. They don't really look like they made any changes this year to say, oh, maybe Pittsburgh is going to turn it around this year. They've been a losing team. And he said, yeah, no, it doesn't hurt to have a team like that wants to have you. His agent actually was also interviewed, and his agent said, yeah, we're looking at all options. All options are on the table. They want to get Crosby a few more Stanley Cups by the time he retires. He's not getting any younger. He compared Crosby to Tom Brady and said, like, yep, Tom Brady went and won a Lombardi Trophy with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, so maybe Crosby wants to send off with a younger team too. I mean, I'm all for it because obviously I'm a Montreal Canadiens fan, and just having Sidney Crosby, who is arguably one of the best, I mean, not even arguably, but one of the best hockey players of all time on your team would be awesome. I think that would be great for the team. I think it'd be a great leader. But man, I was like, wow, these words are crazy. I'm wondering what Pittsburgh thinks about this. Like, what are these fans going off? Like, I feel like your leader for so long is all of a sudden just open to being gone and out of Pittsburgh. Sam, what do you think about that?
Honestly, it gives me goosebumps. There's no team more fitting for Crosby to be traded to other than the Montreal Canadiens. I say that wholeheartedly, though. I mean, the more I think about it, there is no team in professional sports that has seen more cultural legends go through their system. People have written literal dissertations on the players in the Montreal Canadiens and the impact they've had. And no other sport is that apparent. And for Crosby, someone who I think people kind of view as the chosen one, in many ways he actually is. Gretzky will always be the great one, but Crosby's kind of the chosen one because he's so humble, and I think he embodies every virtue that Canadians hold near and dear. But if he does end up on Montreal, that is, it's just a poetic ending to what is going to go down as one of the most legendary careers of all time, and legendary in the most legitimate sense too. Not legendary just because he was good, but legendary because of who he was. Mm-hmm. Granted, though, if he does go there, there's some actual logistical things I think Montreal would have to figure out.
Yep.
I mean, how do you say no to Sid the Kid and say, yeah, you're not captain anymore? I think Nick Suzuki has to bow down and confess, as every other tongue has, that Crosby is the greatest captain of all time. And if anything, he has to unsew or steam off the sea from his jersey, depending on how Montreal works with their equipment, and sew it back on himself on the Sids. But like, my point is, though, that actually does disrupt the locker room. And I think the guys do like Nick Suzuki. He seems like a really great guy. If anything, they might bring back a co-captaincy thing between Crosby and Nick Suzuki. I feel like that'd be equitable. But it's pretty crazy. It's crazy. But yeah, Crosby leaving Pittsburgh is like Messi leaving Barca.
Yeah.
No. Actually, it literally is like that.
Yeah. It is honestly like probably the biggest player I've ever even heard rumored to be traded to Montreal, like in my lifetime. Because, I mean, this is just unheard of. Like, this feels like I get like flashbacks to when I was younger and like Stamkos to Toronto. I remember that was a huge thing. Like, Steven Stamkos was going to leave the Lightning and go to the Maple Leafs. And I mean, this is like that, but like on times 10 almost. So, I mean, I think that, yeah, they would have maybe some issues when it comes to like who's going to lead the team, like on paper. I actually disagree with you, Sam. I think Crosby would be okay with letting Suzuki captain that team and taking maybe an alternate.
I don't think Crosby would
mind. Yeah. Okay, no, I don't think that. I honestly think Crosby would want Suzuki to lead because Suzuki's been leading this team for 2 or 3 years now. And I mean, it is kind of his team. Like, I understand that Crosby coming in would be a huge like game changer, but I kind of think of it as almost like a reverse John Tavares, Austin Matthews situation. Like, Matthews took over when Tavares was getting older and wasn't as productive, even though Tavares was still productive and a great leader, right? And yeah. I honestly think that that would be a similar case with Crosby coming in. I mean, he isn't really the young leader that Matthews is on the Leafs. Like, Suzuki's that guy. So I think that maybe because he's coming in at such an older age, maybe he would take the A. But I mean, we're talking like huge hypotheticals right now. Like, I feel like we're getting way too into it before anything actually happens. I mean, this is even like talking about what Montreal needs to give up to get Sidney Crosby. Like, yeah, it's gonna be tons of draft picks, and it's probably gonna be one of their core pieces with a few prospects. Crosby's still a great player. I mean, it's not like he's gonna come cheap. So, yeah,
crazy. You know, this is the appeal Crosby has in some way. Mm-hmm. Larry Robinson wrote a really great book about his time with the Montreal Canadiens, and one of the first things he says in chapter 2 is that when he went to his first training camp with the Canadiens, he was handed a pair of shin pads. At the time, players didn't come with their own equipment. Yep. It was all owned by the team, and they would borrow it from the team. And he looked in the shin pads, and they didn't fit, and he tried to rip off one of the covers to make it a bit bigger. And he saw inside that it was inscribed, Le Rocket Richard. It's like the Rocket Morris Richard. I mean, Larry Robinson said he didn't even know what to do.
Yeah.
He just handed them back. And when they asked him why, he said, I can't wear these. Like, Crosby has that same effect too in some ways.
Yeah.
Nick Suzuki grew up watching Crosby. That's the only reason why I say that. If anyone's going to get the take off the seat, it'll be Suzuki from himself. But I agree. This is Suzuki's team. But anyways, maybe we should stop talking about hypotheticals and talk about what actually happened. Mm-hmm. Monday Night Football was yesterday. Sunday night, the day before. Some crazy stuff. I mean, I don't know if you've been watching the greater standings, Adam, but the AFC East, other than the Bills, kind of pulling through last second, is poo right now. And NFC South also did pretty badly.
Yeah.
Do you think that's just coincidence, or do you really think that those are going to be the weaker conferences this season?
I thought the AFC East was going to be a lot stronger. And looking at those matchups, so the Bills beating the Ravens, obviously huge. How can we not talk about that Sunday night game? Yeah. Down 15 points with 4 minutes to go. Are you kidding me? Josh Allen is going to step up, and the defense is going to step up, force a fumble on Derrick Henry, who was running all over the Bills all game, force a fumble, take it down, and then a 41-year-old kicker is going to kick the game-winning field goal. Like, come on. Yeah. That's like a storybook like ending. You couldn't get much better. It's the best game of football I've ever watched, especially a Bills game. Insane. But Buffalo is like no quit. That team is like, if they can come back from this, I can't doubt them at all. So I think they'll be strong. Miami got their butts kicked by the Colts. Danny Dimes, Daniel Jones decided to play as like prime Patrick Mahomes and put up 33 points, score on every single possession. I mean, Miami looked rocked. I don't know what to tell you there. The Jets, they were in a shootout with the Steelers, and I think that was a decent game. I think the Jets are better with Justin Fields under quarterback. I think they could be a little bit better, maybe challenge for that second place. And then the Patriots, I had high hopes for them. I thought they might beat the Raiders, but I think the Patriots are another development year. So I think the AFC East is going to be weak, but I also think it's still Josh Allen's division. I think the major change is going to be the Jets and the Dolphins switching for the 2 and the 3. In the NFC South, I believe that's the Buccaneers, Falcons, Panthers, and Saints. Criminally weak division. The Buccaneers and the Falcons played each other, so I think that was kind of a tough way to judge which team's going to be better. It's a very close game with the Buccaneers coming out on top. The Saints and the Panthers, I was high on the Panthers this year. I thought they might turn around, but Bryce Young looked quite abysmal against the Jaguars, and the Jaguars aren't the best team either. So I do think that that is a weak division. But I mean, there were just so many headlines coming out of this game. I don't know, Sam, if you watched the first game of the year. So the Thursday night football game, Dallas Cowboys and Philadelphia Eagles. But the Eagles, Jalen Carter, defensive tackle for the Eagles, was ejected from the game before the first snap for spitting on Dallas's quarterback, Dak Prescott. And I don't know, did you see that?
I heard about that, but I didn't really pay too much attention to it, frankly. Although maybe you can run it through us for the viewer as well.
Yeah, no, of course. So it was, yeah, Jalen Carter goes onto the field. Dak spits on the ground. And I think Jalen Carter looks at that and is like, oh, you just spat on me. So he spits on Dak right in front of the referee. Immediate ejection. Spitting is not tolerated in the NFL, like on players. Mm-hmm. And he just got fined $57,000 for that spit. So he has not played a game. He was gone the whole game, like tossed before the game even started. He's one of their best defensive players and was key to the Eagles' Super Bowl run last year. So this is a major player getting rage baited by Dak Prescott at the beginning of the game and kicked out of the game. I couldn't believe it. I've never seen anything like it. Wild stuff to start the season. But yeah, no, just crazy.
The Eagles still won, though.
Yeah, the Eagles did still win, so they were able to pull it out. Clearly, they didn't need him too much, but it was a close game. I didn't expect it to be a close game. But there were a few other highlights from season's week one. We saw we saw Micah Parsons make his debut for the Green Bay Packers. That was a huge controversy, kind of just his trade in the offseason from the Cowboys. And the Packers destroyed the Detroit Lions, and the Lions are one of the best teams in the league. Shout out Jack Stubbs for being number one Lions fan, but they got you this week, buddy. The Packers were all over them. But yeah, no, there's some exciting times. The NFL was exciting. This was a good week. The Monday night game was all right. We got to see JJ McCarthy's debut for the Minnesota Vikings, and Caleb Williams looked like Caleb Williams. So, I mean, it was a good game, nothing too special. But yeah, no, kind of going into some other news, the NBA, we have a contract extension. Josh Giddey agreed to a 4-year, $100 million contract extension with the Chicago Bulls. Now, Sam, you're shaking your head. You're banging your head against the table. What do you think about Josh Giddey getting a 4-year, $100 million deal? And I know we don't talk about basketball very often, but I know Josh Giddey is very close to your heart.
Yeah, well, I actually don't really care for him that much. That's mostly why I think it's ridiculous that he got paid that much money. He's good. He's not that good. I don't know. It's ridiculous how much these guys get paid to flop around the court and get like a swollen pinky and have to spend the rest of the season out. You know, they're actually, funny story, I read this summer. It was in The Economist. Great, great article. Usually I'm really critical in these articles. This is one of the best ones I've ever read in my life. It said that the average NBA player only plays 48% of the games that he could be eligible to play because they're injured from minor injuries that wouldn't even constitute missing a shift in the National Hockey League. So I'm sorry. He's basically getting paid $100 million to flop around like a fish and do a worse job of flopping around like a fish than a fish would do. I just think that's ridiculous. And also, there's a reason why no one watches the NBA anymore. I don't think we talk about this enough. They have completely vacant arenas. Completely vacant. Everything is CGI in the stands. Not actually, but they may as well be for the purpose of this. In fact, rumor is on the streets of Montreal that the WNBA is going to surpass the NBA in terms of attendance. Also not remotely true, but it feels that way. So I'm sorry. I'm someone who like doesn't even make a difference and who no one really cares about should not be getting paid $100 million. He's not worth it. He's just not worth it. I don't know. He's not worth $100 million over 4 years.
No, I agree with you. I think he averaged 12 points last year over 70 games, and to get a $100 million contract extension is insane.
Imagine giving Jordan Ben, Jamie Ben's brother, $100 million over 7 years. That's what that's equal to.
No, okay, I don't know about that, but I do know what you mean. Speaking of CGI crowds, I don't know if you're on Instagram Reels or YouTube Shorts. I don't know what your deal is these days, but did you see like Will Smith was using like CGI for his crowds at his concerts?
No, I had no idea. Man, actually, that's really
check that out. That's side note, not sports related at all. But Will Smith was like, I know he released these like last few songs, and he apparently was using CGI and AI crowds for his promotion videos, which I just thought was funny. I mean,
that's Will Smith thing to do, though.
Poor guy. But yeah, no, that was the week in sports for the most part. Some other side note that Sam, some news for you is Mike, Babcock, former Leafs coach, the official four-ball team of Mike Babcock at Queen's University is back. And this team has been assembled with, Aiden Peterson, Jack Stubbs, myself, Jack Lowe's. We are all coming back to try to win again. So if you're thinking about visiting Kingston anytime soon and you want to come and play a match with us, I'll let you know when our schedule is.
That sounds great. Well, what Adam's not saying, guys, is that Adam's actually a national floorball ball hockey champion at Queens.
This is completely false. Completely false.
No, it's true. It's true. It's true. We did win.
Okay, you're right. We did win one.
Yeah, we did. So we are former national champions. Not really national, but... We're former intramural champions at Queens. We have the t-shirts to prove it too. So this team has a bit of a legacy. In its first year, it suffered a lot in COVID. The first reason it suffered is we suffered a huge infraction from not showing up for the first two games. Even though we won every game after that by gross scores in which we showed no mercy whatsoever, we still didn't make the playoffs. In our second year as a team, we also struggled to produce any success whatsoever, and I think we might have won a game, although I don't think we did.
I think we lost every game that year.
Yeah, but in the third year, we didn't lose at all.
Yeah.
Actually, a lot of that's due to Kyle's defense. Kyle's defense is really good.
Yep.
He was known kind of as a little like red squirrel out there, and Adam was a fantastic goalie too, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yeah, allowed tons of goals.
No, Adam was the best of the goalies, and at the time, I was also quite a bit larger than I am now. I definitely... covered a larger surface area, and I still suffered in nets compared to Adam, who was most fantastic.
No.
So I expect many great things from this team. But can I actually just say one thing about Queen Sports, though? Queen's women's rugby just had their season home opener against York, and they won 160-0.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like we can't not talk about that. That's insane.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, that's... Yeah.
A shout-out to a few of the players who did pretty good. One of them... A very good friend of, well, actually, she's been on the podcast before last year. A very good friend of my little sister is also on the rugby team. Kylie Chandran had 4 tries in that game.
Wow.
Not bad. 20 points for her. So a lot of players really stepped up to the plate. Granted, it was a good team collective effort, or good collective team effort, sorry. But Kylie really stood out that game. So I thought I should mention that. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, Queens is just really good. Queens sports right now is quite good, though. Queens women's rugby is ranked number 1. I believe Queens men's basketball is ranked number 10 nationwide, and Queens men's hockey is ranked number 5 nationwide. So yeah, things are looking pretty good in the realm of sports for Queens University. Adam being a former Queens athlete, can speak to the excellence that is required and instilled in all the athletes. But do you think this reflects something about the university's athletic program, or just the fact that it is just a good school that people want to go to and they happen to be athletic also?
Yeah, no, I think the university does a great job at funding the athletic department. I think that there's a lot of good coaches, and there's a lot of good athletes. They do a great job recruiting, and they do a great job coaching. I mean, development at Queens seems to be great. This is not an advertisement if you do not go to Queens University, but I mean, this is where the sports are some of the best in the nation. I mean, I don't know what McGill's looking like, but Queens does it pretty good. Now, we do have to wrap up. That's all we can talk about today on the podcast, but we will see you next week, Thursday at 5:30. Have a great night.
Quilt is a literary publication for and by undergraduate students here at Queens. We are open for submissions of creative and academic writing for our upcoming themed volume, Abundance. All subjects and styles are welcome, so long as they align with our theme, and we welcome creative and wide interpretation of that theme. Submissions should be short, sweet, and, as always, brilliant. To learn more, to read our past volumes, and to submit, head to our Instagram at QUQuilt. We can't wait to read your work. Love, Quilt.